This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Episode 35 of The Bowery Boys, The British Invasion.
Hey, it's The Bowery Boys.
Hey.
The Bowery Boys is brought to you by Eurocheapo.com. Eurocheapo editors personally visit and review the best budget hotels in Europe. Now with hotels in New York City, on the web at eurocheapo.com.
Hello there, and welcome to the Bowery Boys. My name is Greg Young.
And I'm Tom Myers.
And we will be talking about the British invasion today. And no, my friends, that does not mean when the Beatles went to the Plaza Hotel and to...
No, none of that. But that's what I did all my research on, Greg.
Oh, my God. We're going to be completely, like, verklempt. Anyway,
This
is when the British invaded New York City in 1776. During the American Revolution, the start of America's independence, back when George Washington, the Continental Army, weren't looking as legendary and iconic and the thing that we would read in history books. It would be quite a different group of people defending against the British.
And this is also the story of a young colony and a young city of Manhattan, New York, what it was like in the town at the time of the invasion, and what it would have been like to watch as the Continental Force got pushed back.
Further back. We'll be visiting not only mainland New York, the cosmopolitan New York, which you'll find out about, but also the sort of wilderness of Brooklyn and how that plays into American independence now. And we'll also be mentioning a lot of places and people that still have leave an imprint here
and
in New
many
York.
Of them have names that are ringing familiar today.
Oh, that you still come across. I mean, their influence and importance are still with us. So
get out your battle maps, because we're going to talk about some major battles that took place in some rather benign areas today.
Yes. Get out those drums and your fife, and you know, we're going to celebrate American patriotism, maybe a darker shade of it, because this is America's most happiest moments, but it is part of and one of New York's most important eras of history. We are going to the invasion. So the world that we're about to visit is a New York that is completely different than the one we have now. Tom, why don't you take us back to 1763, where
Shall
we're
going
to begin our journey?
Right. Well, you know, you say it's completely different. I will argue that in 1763, New York was actually already cosmopolitan.
Okay.
And though small, it sort of felt like a metropolis because you had a very diverse mix of people. The population was made up of all manner of religions, Protestants, Anglicans, Dutch Reformed, Lutherans, Quakers. There weren't very many Jews and Catholics because they had lost certain rights, so many of them had left. But still, you can imagine the different languages being spoken. And all of this in a town that had a population of just over about 20,000 in 1763.
20,000 people.
Right.
It doesn't seem like much, but you're right. That was probably a huge – that's a urban center for that period of time.
And small geographically, too. Of course, New York was centered on the southern tip of Manhattan, going up only till what would be about City Hall Park today would be the northern mm-hmm. limit of the city. City Hall, of course, was down on Wall Street.
Oh, that's right. City Hall was an area called the Commons. It was just sort of a grassy land.
Today's City Hall
was
the Commons.
Yeah, today's City Hall, yes.
And the City Hall at the time
was down on Wall Street.
Right. And the government was actually sort of a hybrid. It was, there was a royally appointed leader, governor, and mayor type. There was a democracy. They elected minor officials. So it was a sort of mix. There was a state assembly that was elected by voters. And society was, you know, based on, well, there were upper classes who were landowners and merchants and lawyers, and then a middle class. And then there was a very large lower class as well who did a lot of the work. But it was a functional small town, small-ish town with good industry based on shipping, so, you know, small stores and small factories. But it would have been a very interesting place to be.
And the British had been in charge basically for 100 years by this particular time, almost exactly 100 right. years by this time.
But it's hard to imagine a New York being so diverse and yet so small. It's kind
so
of amazing.
So compact, exactly. So, but the events of the world are weighing heavily here on New York City, and the British are under some tension. So in 1763, 1764, the English were actually under a huge amount of debt. They had just battled the French and the Indians in the French and Indian War over here in North America. And so they had a debt of almost 150 million pounds, and they needed some ways to make money. So they sort of looked at the colonists, and they said, you know what? You're benefiting primarily from all this defense that we're doing, so we're going to start charging you for it. You know, they passed all these different laws and these different acts throughout the colonies that basically taxed them.
And of course, the colonists weren't taking the sitting down.
No, and so what happened is the Stamp Act came along. That was in 1765. Basically, that meant that all public documents like wills and marriage certificates, playing cards even, needed this kind of stamp on them.
Playing cards.
Playing cards had to have the stamp, official playing cards of the British Empire. The colonists had no voice in British government. And so the fact that they had to sort of pay money for things to be official, you know, that they consider this to be a form of taxation. The colonists believed that they should have the same rights as Englishmen. New Yorkers led the protests. As a matter of fact, the first Stamp Act Congress, which actually collected the reps of 9 different colonies, met in a building where Federal Hall is today, actually. This was to express their outrage and to pull the colonists together into like one mindset. Meanwhile, outside in the streets, there was all this violence against those who were enforcing the Stamp Act. There were mobs that took to the streets. They were burning the homes of English office holders. The stamps themselves, which were sitting out in the harbor, were just effectively destroyed, were burned.
Because the stamps had come over in giant vessels and were just stuck out at sea in the harbor, stuck on the ships.
Yes.
Because nobody dared to bring them on.
Well, of course not. It was too incensed. So even when this act was later appealed, it didn't matter. The spark of independence had already been lit. You know, there was a huge boycott of British goods. In New York, there was an underground organization. One could say a terrorist organization, if you're looking at it from one way, called the Sons of Liberty. They also linked to groups in Boston and to other major cities. They often used violence in getting their point across, basically.
Who were they?
Well, it was New Yorkers, rebels. It was led by this man named Alexander McDougall. When the act was repealed, the Sons of Liberty hoisted up what they call a liberty pole up in the Common Grounds area. It was basically just a way to like send messages to others in their organization, and it was rather rebellious. So naturally, the British kept ripping it down, and they kept putting it back up again, and they kept being ripped down again. Over the course of like 10 years, this unrest even spawned what is kind of almost considered one of the first battles of American independence in 1770, and it was a battle called the Battle of Golden Hill, which sounds like it's in some exotic place. It's literally on where John and William Street is today in downtown Financial District.
Wow.
It was a violent protest between British soldiers who were handing out these pro-British handbills, and so there was just fisticuffs happened, and there was some bloodshed. And this was in 1770. So this was one of the first.
So this is still 6 years before the revolution, and tempers are boiling.
Right, but I'm going to gloss over this really quickly because a lot of this happened outside of New York.
Right, history buffs, pour another drink.
The colonists unite, you know, first under the Articles of Association in 1774, New York being one of the colonies.
Right,
colonies,
of course.
You know, by this time, the British troops were amassing and have already been fighting the barely newly formed Continental Army, which is being led by young George Washington. the Battle of Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts, and of course the Battle of Bunker Hill, this year-long siege, which basically forced the British out of Boston. So the British fled to Halifax. Washington knew, though, that they were that the next target would be the next biggest port. That would be New York.
Had war already been declared? What year are we in?
No one actually hasn't officially been declared because...
So Washington was the head of an American army even while there wasn't a formal...
They were going to war, but we didn't have... Our Declaration of Independence would come a little bit later. So Washington and his Continental Army already started to amass themselves in New York on April 13th of 1776. And getting recruits from all over the place, having all of these soldiers from every little colony, lots of poor men, boys who are coming to the town, a lot of them getting sick because it's the summertime and a lot of them away from their families for the first time. So New York's a little bit chaotic at this point. Then, finally, we get to July the 4th, 1776. And the Declaration of Independence is, of course, penned in Philadelphia. Washington, a few days later, Washington triumphantly reads the Declaration of Independence to these newly grouped soldiers and to all these crowds who are just, you know, hankering for some action, I guess.
In New York.
In New York. He reads it at the Commons, the same area that where the Liberty Pole had been. So the crowds get so enraged that they rush downtown to Bowling Green. And down there was a statue of King George on his horse. They get so enraged that they pull the statue down and they behead him.
Oh.
And then they turn some of the statue into bullets to be used in the war, or at least that's what they plan to do.
So they threaten to melt down the king for bullets to fight the king. July of 76.
This is July of 1776 in the heart of independence time. But it's not quite so rosy because here come the British. Washington was right. The British indeed are coming. Just a few days later, the British do enter New York Harbor. They encamp on Tory-friendly, loyalist Staten Island, with New Dorp being there where they camp out when they camp at first.
Now, when you say, I'm sorry, loyalist-friendly Tory territory. Well, so the Tories were friendly to the crown.
Correct. They're friendly to the crown. And then
we will also be calling the loyalists.
And then on the other side, we have the patriots or the rebels, depending on how you want it. We'll mention
their political party was the Whigs.
So the ships come into New York Harbor. People are sitting on their roofs and they're just looking aghast in terror at these approaching ships. There were only about, at this time, 30,000 New Yorkers now in 1776. Right. There were, you know, double that amount of British troops and Hessians, these
hired German soldiers.
German mercenaries, right. And just to sort of like tease and frighten the New Yorkers even more, and this is a little bit of foreshadowing, two ships would sail up the Hudson on the Hudson side, not the East River side, and they would exchange fire with a couple forts, including Fort George, which would have a young 19-year-old King's College student by the name of Alexander Hamilton there, lighting some of the cannon fires. The British would easily go up the Hudson and back, and so this is a little bit of foreshadowing, and Washington has this in mind for later, because they could be basically bottled in to Manhattan if they were to get to the top of the island and cut them off.
And they'd be stuck.
Yes. So on July 13th, the Admiral Lord Howe, the leader of the British Army, sends a message to, quote, Mr. Washington. And
Stripping him of his title.
Asking him for a meeting. The note is rejected. Since as July 4th, he is now General Washington.
This rings a bell. I've heard this. This was also perhaps Mr. Stuyvesant.
Peter Stuyvesant did the very same thing to the British, actually. I don't know whether he got this idea from them, but I do find that an interesting
maybe
parallel.
Maybe he heard our podcast.
He's like, oh, that sounds like a good idea, Peter. Thanks. So, but this happens two or three times, but they do finally meet. He meets one of Howe's emissaries. But Washington casts such a domineering theatrical presence. Like, he becomes a leader of a newfound nation that the British, you know, are trying to squash. And here's like a man that's going to be very hard to beat.
Right. He's talking about change.
He's changed. So he will not back down. So that falls through. The British attack. Now, Washington splits his army. Half of them go over to the Brooklyn side, and half of them stay in New York. The British land on Gravesend Bay in Brooklyn, 88 frigates of soldiers.
Excuse me?
Frigates
of soldiers?
Yes. I mean, a lot of
88
soldiers.
Of them. Yeah.
A lot of soldiers. Brooklyn was basically chosen to be attacked first because it was very sparsely populated and a lot of loyalist sympathizers were over there. Washington sent the troops that he sent to Brooklyn, they manned various forts throughout Brooklyn that they expect to come into contact with the British. There's Fort Box and there's Fort Greene, there's Fort Putnam. Unfortunately, there's one area that they just didn't guard very well. He sent 5 soldiers to sort of watch over and guard what was called the Jamaica Pass. Now, unfortunately, this is what the British choose to make their entry into Brooklyn towards Brooklyn Heights, where a lot of his men are stationed at.
So the American army had 5 soldiers?
No, they had
5 soldiers who were up against the British force.
5 soldiers at Jamaica Pass, correct. And they were, of course, like immediately captured. And so, by the way, that is to the Brooklyn borough of East New York.
Okay.
If you know where that is. They had no problem driving the Continental Army back, and they suffered really huge losses. They were forced to cross Gowanus Creek, which back then was actually a nice creek and not a polluted, disgusting creek as it is today. On August 27th, the British took up a strategic military position in this place called the Vect Farmhouse, where 2,000 of their soldiers blocked the rebels' retreat. Now, I'm mentioning this because it's now referred to as the Old Stone House, and it's a place that you can visit in Brooklyn. It's still standing. A brave number of rebel soldiers led by William Alexander actually took this house from the British twice in one day before eventually being taken prisoner. But because of this, most of Washington's army was able to cross Gowanus Creek in time.
So Washington's army is getting pushed back through Brooklyn by the British force.
Yes, and essentially.
And they're getting pushed back up to what? Brooklyn Heights?
They're in Brooklyn Heights, as a matter of fact.
They're back up against the wall.
And, I mean, they don't have enough, you know, do they have enough time to escape? Well, luckily, they can't fight, can they? Well, so Washington decides that they cannot, that they all need to retreat to Manhattan. So on the night of August 29th, he evacuates all 9,000 soldiers that he has left back to Manhattan. And at night, using literally every conceivable floating device that they could possibly find, just shipping all these soldiers back and forth. That's really hard to do on the East River at night.
With 9,000 men.
Quietly, exactly. By sunrise, they still didn't have everyone across. If they had been caught retreating, I mean, this would have been totally easy pickings for the British. Luckily, a thick fog had crawled in at that particular moment and basically covered the Americans, the rebels, if you will, until they were all safely back to Manhattan.
Wow, fortuitous.
The New York Times calls BritBox the best of British telly. Stream acclaimed original series, including Payback, starring Peter Mullen, Stonehouse, starring Matthew McFadyen, and Archie, the man who became Cary Grant, starring Jason Isaacs. Plus, discover powerful new series like The Three Little Birds and the return of BAFTA-winning drama, Time, starring Bella Ramsey, Tamara Lawrence, and Jodie Whittaker. Stream the best of British TV, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
But now here they are all in Manhattan. You have like hundreds of injured soldiers. The morale is really down because they've just retreated.
Well, they've been pushed back, yeah.
And so
I'm like a child. And then?
Well, and then the Americans' rebel delegation, if you will, makes another attempt, a sort of a peace treaty. This one, I believe we mentioned this in our Staten Island podcast. John Adams, Ben Franklin, Edward Rutledge met General Howe in Staten Island to see if they could work something out. The Americans still refused to capitulate on the declaration. Howe refused to back down, so that didn't work. So the British were basically ready to like attack Manhattan. Washington, though, and something that may look like a little cowardice now, but he had to think about this army was the only thing standing between the British and the making of a new America. He had to really preserve the army, even if he made some decisions that seemed, at the time, a little cowardly. So basically what he decided, he didn't want to be bottled in. He decides to completely abandon New York.
Which would also be a choice to abandon the New Yorkers, because there were Americans who were living, you know, there were 30,000 people living in the city. And he was just basically throwing the city up into the air and saying, let's hope it lands on its feet.
Well, I'm sure that they weren't happy with the, well, you know, I'm not sure if they were happy with leaving, or maybe they were. Maybe it was like, well, if you leave, then they're not going to, you know, they won't bomb us. So on September 15th, the British do finally land in Manhattan. And where do they land? They land in Kips Bay, which is basically on 34th Street on the East River. What's where the heliport is now, if you know where all the helicopters land in Manhattan.
The 34th and the East River?
Yes.
And behind Bellevue Hospital?
That's where they landed. They caught the back flank of Washington's evacuating army. They didn't catch the whole thing on its way out. They only caught the back. The Americans at the back, they were unprepared. They fled, leaving their supplies. 320 of them were captured as prisoners. Washington was even later said he was ashamed of these fleeing soldiers. He called it scandalous and disgraceful. But here's the thing, is that the British would have captured many more men, would have actually probably killed or captured at least half of his army, if it wasn't for a charming middle-aged lady by the name of Mrs. Robert Murray. Now, you might be like, why is a woman in the story of all these men fighting on battlefields?
And who is this Mrs. Murray?
She was the wife of an officer, a mother, and a Quaker. Her home, which was in today's Murray Hill, her last name's Murray, you might see a connection there. She delayed William Howe and his colonels by inviting them up for tea and wine. So, because, you know, they were really exhausted, and here's a kindly lady offering them, you know, tea and some rest for the colonels, for the men, you know, making the decisions. You know, the British, they cannot turn down a good cup of tea.
No, they can't.
And so this social tactic, they say, I like to believe this, even though I think it's a little bit urban legend, this social tactic may have delayed the British enough so that a bulk of the Continental Army could actually escape.
So, wait, how did she get their attention? She just like stuck her head out the window and said, "Boys, come up for tea."
Well, she was a woman of high class, and you know, she had her methods. Women have their ways. So Washington and the Continental Army go up to northern Manhattan to an area called Harlem Heights. This is the area that's sort of modern West Harlem and Columbia University, you know, Morningside Heights area.
Sure.
That bluff, by the way, is so perfect for watching enemies advance. Washington's home base.
And great also for watching drug deals, by the way.
Oh, in the park?
Yeah. No, you can see from that, that's just an aside. You can look out over the park, Morningside Heights.
I didn't know that detail. Washington's home base was not, I don't think he had that view from his window, was the mansion home of the Colonel Roger Morris. Now, does his name sound familiar to you, Tom?
Morris Jumel?
Well, it would later be the home of Eliza Jumel.
Right.
And we mentioned that she was haunting this house in our ghost podcast. It's a famous one of the oldest houses in New York City. On September 16th, the fighting commenced up there in Harlem Heights with another 2,000 American soldiers against 5,000 British soldiers at this particular time. Still outnumbered, the Continental Army were retreating slightly. Then the British make this, what I would say, almost hilarious strategic error. They start blowing these foxhound horns. You know, like the when the British foxhound hunts, they blow these horns.
But they had just brought them over?
Well, they have them on their as part of their regalia, I believe.
Don't you be getting an email about this? Yes. So
anyway,
they take off their fox horn.
Some of them have fox horns anyway, and so they start blowing them. The Continental Army hears them, and it's almost an insult. Like, oh, you think you're just going to like chase us down like foxes now? You think this is going to be the end? So they almost like regain their spirit and regain their confidence. And the Harlem Heights battle ends up almost being a draw with more British losses than losses on the rebel side.
Because the Continental Army was offended by a sort of unintentional metaphor?
Well, it was a mixture of actually having...
I mean, these soldiers were deep.
It was a mixture of metaphors and then, you know, actually having like a good place to battle from.
Okay.
And, you know, and maybe they might have even had some food in them. I don't know at this time. Unfortunately, the Continental Army does have to give up Manhattan Island. Just strategically, it makes sense. They head on into New Jersey and they have many more adventures, which we won't be talking about anymore since we're just sticking here in Manhattan.
Right, the Jersey Boys can actually tell that in their podcast. So we've got the British basically taking over New York City in one fell swoop.
Yeah, but they got some stuff that they've got to deal with down in New York while that's been going on. So then on September 21st, the Great Fire of 1776, that's right, a huge fire sweeps through New York. It started at the Fighting Cox Tavern. There were no alarms, curiously, because most of them had been melted down for ammunition. So the fire spread very, very quickly. It eventually took almost 400. It almost took 400 to 500 buildings.
It took a quarter of the town, right? Yeah. A quarter of the homes too.
That must have looked so frightening, just on top of this battle already happening.
Obviously, because the city was so compact and pushed down in the southern tip of Manhattan, when a fire like that spread, it was the Great Fire of 76, and it just took out a whole dense quarter and left so many people homeless at a time when they were already stressed because there were so many people in need of housing.
They just didn't need this happening.
This was a bad time. And of course, there were all kinds of conspiracy theories about who was responsible for this.
Well, yes, they thought that it was a rebel plan, but later Washington claims that it was not.
In fact, Washington, according to the accounts I read, was telling his soldiers not to touch or harm any building on the way out. They didn't want this to be a sort of like, you know, raise it to the ground on the way out of town ordeal, because they were going to be hopefully coming back soon to New York, which was their pride.
But they did. The British did interrogate almost 200 people. They shot a lot of people just on suspicion. Then while this was going on, they ended up capturing a young spy by the name of, and this one will tickle your ears if you're a history buff, Nathan Hale. He was apprehended in Flushing Bay, Queens, actually, at a tavern, and he was brought back. He was accused of being a spy, and he was hung on September 22nd, but not before, of course, he gave his famous line that all of history now records, "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country." You know, his story has entered the fabric of American tales of American independence.
Wow, I didn't realize that happened. I had never placed it into the American Revolution in New York like that.
And it was, he was killed here in Manhattan. So New York then became the British military operation base. And for, I guess, the next several years, it's the center of loyalist British life.
Okay, Greg, I think I've been following the whole story correctly. Washington's army has been pushed out of town. The British are here. They've taken over New York City. And basically, we have a chaotic situation now in which New Yorkers have to make a choice whether to stay or to go. If they stay, they have to pledge allegiance to the king. If they go, well, where do they go?
And, you know, the general mood is, well, Washington kind of just got his butt kicked. The army is a weak, frail army. They're about to see some real hard times in New Jersey.
It's 1776, and a war that would go on for another 7 years has really just begun.
You know, American independence is on the edge of a knife, as they say. And the British have really shown their dominance here, and they sit here in New York, and they it's now theirs.
In fact, right, New York would function then for the next 7 years throughout the course of the Revolutionary War, really as the central point of command for the British.
So, I mean, what would life be like then for the next 6 or 7 years? How would it be to be a citizen of New York City? What would you have to be going through? What would you have to put up with?
Well, I'm glad you asked, and dear listener, that is the subject of next week's podcast because, well, this is a two-parter in which we're telling the entire story of the Revolutionary War from the perspective of New York City. Today, we got to look at the war and how New York switched hands.
The invasion.
The invasion. And next week, we will be talking about what it was like to live as a New Yorker inside, basically, the fortress, the British fortress that was New York for 7 years.
And all I have to say is this. If you thought New York was bad in the 1970s, just wait till you look at New York in the late 1770s. You know,
it was no walk in the Central Park. It was a rough city, and there were rough times. There was cold, there was famine, and there were also a lot of soldiers and a lot of empty and burned houses.
So all those details we'll have for you next week. Until then, I hope that you will visit our blog at BoweryBoysPodcast.com. Hopefully you've also, wherever you download this from, any podcast provider, but if you download from iTunes, if you like what we do, go to iTunes and write up a little review. That would be wonderful.
And we do appreciate those. And we also love it if you happen to be on Facebook, if you'll swing on by, type in Bowery Boys into Facebook, and you'll be able to see our profile and join the page. And it's fun because we can all see each other.
And we have pictures that I don't have available on the podcast and all sorts of fun stuff.
Right. Plus, we can do little contests and fun things like that.
So next week, we will be coming back to this era of New York City. We have a lot of interesting stuff to surprise you with. So tune on in. It was very nice to have you with us this week. Have a great New York week, whether you live here or not.
See you next week.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.